This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Radiolab builds itself as a show about curiosity. The program explores ideas in science, philosophy, and sociology through storytelling and sound-based experiences, like, for instance, using a choir to demonstrate what a rainbow might look like to animals with more color receptors.
Here's the dog. Here's us, humans. And finally, the butterfly.
So I'm now thinking butterflies get the crown.
Yeah, but then if you go onto coral reefs, you come across these animals called mantis shrimps. They have two really big eyes right on the front.
And you said that dogs have two cones. We have three. How much does the butterfly have again?
Butterfly has five. Mantis shrimps have 16.
16? Oh, my God.
Well, if you have 16...
16 kinds of receptors.
What would the rainbow look like to them? I mean, could they even see it?
Sound experiments like that are a big part of Radiolab, which challenges our perception and perspectives about the human experience. Radiolab is on more than 450 NPR stations, including WUNC and WHQR. And co-host Jad Abumrad is on the show with us now. He's going to give a talk at the Carolina Theater in Durham this Sunday at 8 o'clock. But first, he's here on the State of Things. Jad, welcome. Good to have you here.
Hey, great to be here, Frank.
Tell us more about Radiolab for those, the eight or nine of us in the audience who have not actually heard the program. It's a fabulous program. But tell us about sort of what you're going for in this program.
This is always the question where I run myself into a fugue state and fall over, because it's a very hard show to describe, Frank. I mean, it's something like what you said. It's an exploration of the place where science and culture and philosophy and sometimes politics and sometimes sociology all kind of slam together. And usually what we do is we take one big idea and we try and sort of take a whirlwind tour through that idea over the course of an hour. And often that means going to the scientist and asking them, like, okay, what is time? What does it mean? What's the precise definition of time? And then you go and you talk to somebody who, say, got in a car crash and had that very common experience of time slowing down. And you ask that person, what happened in that moment? And you sort of compare and contrast all the different ways of thinking about time. And then you get very confused and very delighted.
Yeah.
And then put some cool sounds to
What's
it.
What's wonderful about the program is it does just that. There's plenty of science, so that by the time you're done, your head is full of information that you didn't know before, but better. And here's why. It's because now you're full of questions, and everything you thought you understood about the human experience, whether it's how time works or who's the parasite, is it me or them, that is all called into question. And so you do what every educator promises to do but rarely does, which is leave you with more questions than answers. I think it's kind of a cool concept.
Yeah. That's our basic – I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you how it came about.
Well, it's sort of it was one of those strange, slow evolutions. I mean, I started Radiolab as a very different kind of show, 2002. I was broadcasting by myself on this little, tiny, forgotten part of the AM schedule, literally to no one. No one was listening.
In New York City at WNYC.
Yes,
but I take your point.
Exactly.
You're on AM. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't just that. It was that at that time of night, I didn't know this at the time, but they dropped the power of the AM signal because it interferes with other places. And so you had to be hugging the transmitter to get the signal. So at that point, it was, an anthology show. So I would spend 3 hours just playing different documentaries from all around the world. And I would, I would inevitably have 10-minute gaps where I had to fill out the show, and I would do my own reporting in those 10 minutes. And over time, that just kind of grew. And I met Robert, and we both began to think about science together. And, over the course of 4 or 5 years, it began to sound like what it sounds like now. But it was never planned. We had no other intention behind it but just to sort of hang out together and hopefully not get fired.
Robert being Robert Krulwich, who,
that's right,
in a sense, trademarked the sound of NPR in its very earliest days with his political,
yeah,
but mostly his economics reporting, where he would have singing mice demonstrate the impact of inflation, et cetera. And so he did for economics and NPR what you're now doing for science. And so it's fun to hear him back and reprising that same kind of quality. And so let's get an example here of kind of the way the show challenges perspectives and perception. question. Would you first set up the story of Laura Buxton and her balloon for us? Would you set that
sure.
up?
Sure. Yeah. So we were very interested in, to put it crudely, sort of the mathematics of miracles. Like these things happen in our lives which seem beyond coincidence. How can you explain it? We got interested like, okay, so what is the math? Is there a mathematical justification for what we would call a miracle? It turns out there is. And so we began to sort of sift through some coincidence books, which of which apparently there are many. And we ran across this sentence in a book which said, a 10-year-old girl named Laura Buxton lets go of a balloon. The balloon floats 150 miles south, this is in England, and lands in the yard of a 10-year-old girl named Laura Buxton. And we're like, that's just not possible. It's not possible. So we ended up, it was almost impossible. We somehow tracked down both Laura Buxtons on opposite sides of England and had them tell their story.
Yeah, let's listen to a clip.
And he was about to put it in the bin, like literally. And then he saw the label saying, please send back to Laura Buxton. And he was like, oh my God.
Why? Why would he say, oh my God?
Okay, so check this out. Uh-huh. Remember how I told you that the first girl who sent the balloon was 10?
Yeah.
The second girl who received it?
I'm 10 years old.
She's 10. Okay?
Okay.
Wait, there's more.
Better be.
Remember how I told you that the first girl's name was Laura Buxton?
Yeah.
Well, girl number two, can you introduce yourself?
Okay, hi, I'm Laura Buxton.
What?
Girl number one.
Hello, I'm Laura Buxton.
Girl number two.
Hello, I'm Laura Buxton.
They're both Laura Buxton?
Yeah.
No.
Yes.
Both named Laura Buxton.
Yes.
Yeah.
You heard me right. A 10-year-old girl named Laura Buxton lets go of a balloon.
Phew.
That balloon floats 140 miles and lands in the yard of another 10-year-old girl named Laura Buxton.
Is this for real?
Yes. I think it might be the strangest thing I've ever heard in my life.
It's pretty weird.
It is pretty weird. And now you've got it and you've actually found the two Laura Buxtons. So how does the story develop from there?
Well, so we got them into a studio. It turns out they had become friends as a result of this weird coincidence. And so we got them into a studio, and like there were initially what seemed like all of these crazy coincidences. I mean, they sound the same. You can barely tell them apart. They're the same height. They have the same build, more or less. They have the hair that was the same color. They had a rabbit that had the same name, I believe, if memory serves. They were wearing the same clothes practically when they met. And so we take this as an example of, like, how do you explain this? And then we do a sort of a mathematical explanation which shows that, like, if you look at the math, this kind of crazy stuff will actually happen. It is mathematically inevitable that often in your life you will bump into things which seem almost unexplainable. But actually they are explainable because of all the millions of things that happen during the course of a day, it is inevitable that two will bump into each other.
And you found out about that by talking with a statistician named Jay Kohler just to see just how improbable it was. So let's listen.
Laura Buxton didn't find the balloon. Somebody else who knew a Laura Buxton found the balloon. You selected out the features that match. And trust me, somebody checked to see if she was an identical twin and said, no, that's not a good one. Skip the twin. Okay, how many brothers and sisters? Oh, not the same number. Skip that. Ah, they both have a rabbit. Let's put that one in the story.
To be totally honest, he's right.
What? What do you mean?
Well, when I was interviewing the Lauras, I asked them a bunch of questions, kind of scouting for similarities. What's your favorite color, both of you?
Blue, pink.
Scrap that. And what do you guys study in school?
Biology, chemistry, and geography. Whereas I'm doing English and history and classical civilization.
Scrap that.
What people do is they try to make the story better by showing more similarities.
So you're saying that somebody, I couldn't imagine who, doctored the story?
By the way, I don't want to spoil anything, and this is a trivial comment, but I believe that one of the girls was actually 9.
Well, almost 10.
And the other one was 10.
Oh. Oh. No.
Oh, well, the story's ruined. Never mind.
Well, it's not ruined. It's not ruined because you really do shine a light on kind of how we're meaning makers as human beings is what we do. We make connections. We see faces in the clouds. That's what makes us human, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we are pattern-seeking animals, and so this was a great illustration of that. And the story ends with the two of them being like, we don't care. We like each other. We're friends. It doesn't matter.
And the balloon was cool. But I think that, as I say, that is the cool thing, and that you sort of – so the big wide world out there doesn't really set patterns and make us, you know, sort of have a perspective on anything. But then – and it's what we do as humans is kind of create these things. So now to the stories. I mean, how do you – here's my favorite question. How do you find your stories? Do they come to you? Do you people send them to you?
A little bit of both. I mean, we basically read a lot, and we have these big raucous, sometimes almost violent editorial meetings where we're throwing stuff around, story ideas. I mean, not objects, although sometimes that too.
Occasionally.
And you know, we just exchange a bunch of things, and you know, we're in a weird, unique position in radio in that we, I guess, like This American Life, we work on stories over a long, long arc of time, and so. You know, something like the Laura Buxton story it began as a sentence, and then it began as an interview, and then we added a statistician, and then we went to somebody who could explain the math of coin flips, and you slowly start to sort of add, and it changes over the course of, say, 6 months. So we find lots of little pieces, and we put them in our back pocket and just hope that as we're walking around and reading, that we bump into something that makes that thing more interesting and adds to more questions.
Well, the thing that makes it interesting, of course, is the storytelling, and that's the other thing we do. And so by putting all of this information and even these insights into the framework and the context of a story, it just opens the way for all of us so that we don't have to know the arcane language of mathematics or music to understand the way these things work on us, because we all know how to listen to and tell a story.
Yeah, that's right. And we all know how to be curious and to ask questions, and there's a time at which you just ask questions because you're curious, and then you learn what's a good question, what's a bad question, and then you get afraid to ask those questions. And so part of the practice of the show, speaking personally, is learning to unwind the fear of being stupid and just asking the questions which inevitably lead you maybe 4 or 5 steps down the road to something truly interesting. But it always begins by just asking dumb questions, you know?
So you're going to be giving a talk here about when you get to Durham, a talk about innovation and creation when you talk at the Carolina Theater on Sunday. How does that all relate to Radiolab?
Well, you know, this is the every story that we do on Radiolab is a process of asking questions which you know are too simple, you know are dumb, in the hopes that they will yield the next question that you also know isn't quite right, in the hopes that that will yield the next question. And so a lot of our time at Radiolab is spent being lost and not quite knowing what we're doing, because we're wandering to topic areas that we're not experts at. Like we're not beat reporters, so we don't know the ins and outs of everything we're talking about. And we're very upfront about that. And so and also my own creative process personally has been punctuated by moments of profound darkness, maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, and so this talk is about about that story, about the creation of Radiolab, but also about storytelling techniques, but also about reclaiming the darkness and learning the utility of being lost and the practice and the joy of being lost. And so I'm pulling a bunch of different ways of thinking about that state of wandering from, you know, poker playing to Wagner to psychotherapy to Ira Glass to Cherokee dream hunting. I'm sort of taking all, in a very Radiolab-y sort of way, mashing together all these different ways of thinking about the creative process, and particularly the dark parts, in the hopes of reclaiming those parts and making them seem great.
How do they work for you, Jad, the dark parts? Why are they good, and how do they play a part in your creative process?
Well, it's like, I mean, what you want from any story that you're reporting, any story you're listening to, is you want something that is going to transform your life. You want like some moment where you're going to collide with some idea and it's going to just take your perspective with both hands and shake it up and spin you around 360 and then spit you out as a different person. But by definition, you can't know what that's going to be because it is a transformation. You know, you can't pre-know that. And so what do you do when you're looking for it? You know, and so very often for me, you know, we spend 6 months sometimes toiling about in a story, and we're not sure it's going to work. And when we end up killing it and we put it on the shelf, and then something happens, you read something in the Times and you're like, oh, my God, that's the right question. So then you pull the thing off the shelf and you go into it. And it can be a very weird, lonely, dispiriting thing to not know what you're doing for that much time.
Well, I guess the other thing is that there's a tendency to want to make it work and to pull things together that aren't quite there yet, and then not wait for the story to come to you.
Exactly. And sometimes you got to do it because you got a deadline, you know, and like, you know, I would never expect a, you know, Morning Edition or All Things Considered or WNC news reporter to sit in that state of uncertainty for too long because you got to put something out there. But yeah, the premature certainty is the enemy, I think, as I've come to know it. And so this is about like holding on to the uncertainty.
You don't actually have a science background yourself, right? Yours is in music and creative writing.
Well, yeah, I'm a musician and a writer by training, but I do hold to the superficial connection that my parents are scientists, and I grew up, you know, having to go wait in their labs after school, and I'd play with their lab rats. I never quite paid attention to what they did because I guess that's how kids usually are with their parents, but it's into my blood in some sort of superficial sense.
Are they paying attention to what you're doing now, and what do they think of it?
Oh, yeah. They send me all kinds of crazy, arcane PDFs from esoteric journals thinking, you should do a story on, you know, the evolutionary biology of CRISPRs. And I'm like, Mom, I don't know what to do with that. but yeah, so they're very excited. I mean, it feels like our dinner conversations from my childhood are suddenly making sense to me finally.
I do think story ideas from Mom could make a great episode someday. You get that
You know,
thought,
we've it, believe it or not, that's something we're talking about.
There you go.
You know, like the crazy stuff from Mom.
What a coincidence. Jad Abumrad, host of Radio Lab from WNYC and NPR. Jad, thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Jad's going to be speaking at the Carolina Theater in Durham this Sunday at 8 o'clock. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Alex Curley's the intern. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.